Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi everyone, Chris here. This episode will be coming to you in two parts. They're both released at the same time, so listen to part one and then straight away you can listen to part two. Hope you enjoy it. I'm so excited about this episode. It's such a brilliant one. We are live.
Boom.
Hello everybody, welcome to Homo Sapiens. I'm Alan Cumming.
I'm Christopher Sweeney.
And we're very excited this week because our guest is Amru Al-Qadi.
So Amru Al-Qadi goes by the name of Glamru, is a Muslim drag queen. But that would be far too simplistic because Amru is a non-binary drag artist, writer, actor.
Performer. Yes, many, many things. Just a really fascinating person.
Fascinating person who I actually know because this series is about trailblazers and Amru is without doubt a trailblazer because there are not, unfortunately, as many non-binary Muslim drag queens as we would hope there were.
I know.
But I met Amru because they were doing a TV show that was a pilot and they sent me the script and asked me if I wanted to direct it. And I loved the script. And that's how we met. So we ended up hanging out a bit. And they also write with a writer called Matthew Hammond-Knott, who is incredibly funny and wrote a film called Bonobo, which everybody must look at if they are a James Norton fan, because it's one of his first ever things. But it's exciting to be talking to Amru today because they have done incredible stuff. What are you looking forward to?
Well, I just think they're so full of contradictions, or seemingly full of contradictions. And that's what really interests me. They were, you know, rebelled against their Iraqi family. They were a queer kid. And then, unbeknownst to their family, they got this scholarship to Eton. So all of a sudden, they end up in Eton. I would have thought if I was a sort of a queer Iraqi kid, I wanted to rebel and get away to a place where I felt I would be amongst people who understood and liked me, Eton would be the last place I would have gone to. So I'm really fascinated to find out about that. And I don't think there's, you know, there's not many Muslim Iraqi non-binary drag queens. There's not many Muslim Iraqi non-binary Cambridge educated drag queens either, because they went on to Cambridge after that. So I'm just really fascinated about, I'm just really fascinated about all of it, all of them. Can't wait.
And it's been quite fun. It was really fun watching Amru during lockdown and seeing them saying how drag was such an important part of their life and there was no opportunity to get dressed up in drag. So then they just decided they were just going to get dressed up in drag in their sitting room. And
yes,
the whole look, I love that.
Yeah, so that's, I'm really interested about whether or not they'll be in drag for the interview. I hope so.
Oh, do you think we'll get the full service?
I don't know. British time is quite late, so maybe it's not too early to get into drag.
I don't know. We've dressed up, so you know. I'm wearing sports gear.
Wearing?
I did some exercise in 8 hours ago, and Alan, you look very fetching. I won't make any comments about what you're
wearing. I tell you what, I'll go from the bottom. I'm wearing my Croc sandals that are sort of like Birkenstocks, but Crocs make them.
Works for daytime.
Mm-hmm, and I'm wearing orange, sort of those fleecy orange and black socks that you're supposed to wear as like in between a sock and a slipper, sandal.
Comfort
then I'm wearing,
first.
Dark blue overalls or coveralls. Mm-hmm. And then I'm wearing a sort of a tartan headband to keep my unruly mad professor hair out of the way, and with my unruly beard, and my glasses. It's a look.
And head to alancumming.com/shop where you can buy a Homo Sapiens t-shirt. By the way,
right,
look.
See?
Oh God, look, can anyone feel
that? And a sweatshirt.
Why don't I trail the sweatshirts? Much higher margins.
Now we've got that out of the way. It's time for us to chat to Amru Al-Kadi.
Can I ask a question to the group? Do you see any link between nice lighting and queerness? Because I do.
Oh my God. Yes.
Go right in there, Chris, aren't we?
Yeah.
No fucking about.
We said it was the queer women's hour and we're off. Grab your pashminas, people.
Dim lighting is quite queer because we're quite scared of being fully exposed, aren't we?
Let's say Blanche DuBois. That merciless glare.
This is my theory. Who knows if it's right? I think that for our generation, obviously Amru is a bit younger, but...
are you including me in your generation? That's so nice of you.
Alan, listen, this is a long relationship and it needs to go well. I think the trauma of being queer makes you very sensitive. And that means you're very sensitive to light. This is what I think.
I agree with you because also bright light reminds me of that moment when you leave a nightclub and the sun has risen and you're just like, oh God, yeah, I have to engage with the world again.
Yes.
And that really terrifies me, that light. Like sometimes I'll be like, just put me in a cab. I don't want to know. Like I'll cover my eyes. It's sort of straight people walking their kids and they've just got up and you're just like,
and you're covered in
glitter.
How many
drinks have I had in me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Are you talking about Fire in Vauxhall by any chance?
No, Fire in... Burger. It's more like, Fire in Vauxhall. Oh, God, I've never had a good time there, really. Is that still alive?
Shut down,
I think
now.
So. Oh, it shut down, did it? I remember once doing a film and on a sat and our base camp for the in London, this was. And the base camp was, like, quite near Fire. And... we were like driving from base camp to the location, to the actual set, and we would pass early in the morning at the weekend the club and just seeing people, like I'm going to work and I'm all being in makeup, had my breakfast, going to work, and seeing people like kind of all smacked out coming out of the thing blinking away, and I just thought, and we were like, oh look at them, they're just coming out, and I thought, oh my God, that would have been me last weekend, because I was, actually had been doing that the weekend prior to the film starting. I thought, how embarrassing if I was not in this scene and my castmates were going to a thing and they saw me coming out all sweaty.
Yeah, you just feel like you're not an adult and you're on a completely different plane of reality. You're just like, when real people walk past, you're just like, hi, we're not part of the same world right now.
Yes.
I love it.
Yeah, me too.
It's so funny because I remember, it's so funny you saying about the buggy thing, like a grown up with a buggy, because I remember when the first time I ever went to Fire, I took a pill and it made me sick. So I ran outside of Fire to throw up. And as I was puking, I looked up and saw this woman walking with her kids. And I was like, Chris, how did we take a wrong turn this evening?
Amru, I want to ask you, I want to do a deep dive because I'm absolutely fascinated by you in general.
Oh,
actually,
thanks,
but also,
hun.
I'm just really, I want to talk to you about Eton.
Oh, God. Okay.
Tell the world what Eton is like, or what it is and what it's like. And
Okay. So Eton College is probably the most expensive, or one of the most expensive, all-boys private school in the UK, which throughout history for centuries has essentially been a breeding ground for sort of gentry and aristocratic power. Many prime ministers have gone there. The current one, Boris Johnson, has gone there. David Cameron went there. And, you know, it's like a sort of time warp. You have to wear tails, black tailcoats and waistcoats and bow ties.
Every day.
Which was not as fun as I thought it would be. It's definitely a symbol of kind of the enduring British class system, really. And it is... You know, it's like a self-professed sort of, we are the best of British.
It seems to me that, you know, when you were younger and you were kind of rebelling against your family and your Iraqiness and your religion and your queerness, or not rebelling against that, but rebelling against the confines you were in with those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would not have thought that the first thing you might do would be to get a secret scholarship to Eton. What was that about?
Yeah, it was definitely flawed decision making, that's for sure. I think I think it was about many things. I mean, we came to the UK when it was just before the Iraq War, so like around 2003. We'd come just before that, and I was excited to be in the UK. I'd had a great time back in Bahrain and Dubai, but you know, I was definitely realizing what my desires were by, you know, 11, 12, 13, which is around that time. And so, and, you know, being in an Islamic country, which was so kind of constantly reminding me that that was a problem, I was really excited to get to the UK because I just thought, well, this is where Cats, the musical, is. And I was obsessed with Cats growing up. And I thought, like, if I could just be in the country that has,
we should point out that Amru is wearing a sort of leopard skin.
Oh,
yeah.
Jacket. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
You look like McCavity.
Thank you. Well, if McCavity was wearing Cavalli, honey.
I'm kidding.
Clang. Name clang. Clang. Name drop.
Sorry. Clang. Yeah, so I was just really excited. And I remember being quite conflicted because when, you know, Blair sort of announced the Iraq War, I remember my parents being really, I mean, heartbroken, you know, because they literally had a home in Baghdad. And it was, and I remember just being a bit like, well, I'm sort of hating my parents right now in quite a massive way because they were really, you know, as you mentioned, putting a lot of confines on me because they could see that I was just, you know, different to everyone around them. And so I kind of was like, well, I'm living in the UK now, which means that this is the side that I'm on, in quite a sort of binary, basic way that kids can do, because, you know, you're just, you can't really see the big picture yet. And then,
how old are you at this point?
13 by this point. Mm-hmm. And by this point, I just was definitely, you know, knew I was gay and was really just, there was so much forcible resistance from both my parents and also the family at large to the way that I was going. And also they had a lot of rhetoric, which was, although we've brought you to the UK, just don't become British, please. You know, your family's Iraqi. You know, I was only really ever surrounded by Iraqis at home, and some of whom are wonderful, some of whom, you know, aren't, because, you know, family's just that way. And but in my head, I just thought, well, you know, the kind of broad consensus here is that I can't be gay and the way that I'm going is wrong. So I'm going to just fully identify with being British. And, you know, so I stopped speaking Arabic. I stopped fasting, which was a real moment when I would sort of, and I was an asshole about it. I mean, I was eating pork, like, in front of my parents during Ramadan.
What a little shit.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was a kid, thank you very much. But yeah, I wasn't, like, I don't really see myself as purely a victim back then, because I was just like, and I only had one picture of it. I think it's like when you're coming out or you're realizing you're gay, for a while your entire world is about just that one thing. And so it was just like, well, if my parents are telling me that Islam and family won't handle it, then I can't have anything to do with Islam or anything to do with family. And they are really anti-British because of the war. And they're really anti-British because of, they're nervous about me assimilating here. So I'm going to start fantasizing about the most British things ever. And Eton College was obviously like, you know, the biggest British fantasy. You know, I think I also just thought, well, my family are going to reject me because I've been given enough clues. So I need to develop as many kind of tools to do well in this country. And in my head,
structure.
Yeah, another structure. And I was desperately looking for structure in a way that I think loads of kids are. So I was like, let's replace Islam. Let's replace Allah and put Christ in there. Let's just see what happens with that. Let's replace, my entire heritage, which, you know, there was a lot of it that I loved, and, you know, go for constipated British aristocracy.
And figgy pudding.
I tried very hard at Eton. I would literally go around being like, hello, governors, you know, how we doing? And like sort of, oh, it was raining cats and dogs, wouldn't you say, mateys? And they'd just be like, no one talks like that.
Didn't you have a pin board as well, like a beard pin board?
Where... I did.
Tell us about that.
Well, there was definitely no, I mean, my mum slipped in a Quran in my suitcase and I hid that under my bed that I lost my virginity on, which is still something that scars me a little bit. But the pin board just had me with white girls from my old school who I begged to just let them pretend they were my girlfriends. I mean, I was literally building, like, I arrived as like a sort of...
Oh, what, you manufactured this pin board so that it would look like what your life was like?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. I just thought, I'm just setting, you know, a new me. And I didn't want anyone to be like, you know, I wanted to just look natural in the tales, which obviously I didn't, because it was just like the only Iraqi in town who was like the gayest thing ever. And my house changed name. It was called ASR before I arrived, and a term in my honor, they called it GaySR.
Wow.
Just because nice. It was just like obvious to, I tried to, I even auditioned, cause I was always a performer. I auditioned for the chapel choir in front of loads of boys who were all Christian. And they asked me to prepare a hymn, and I sang All I Want for Christmas Is You.
That's, you know, fantastic.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Dick. What did they do? Like, I love to have seen their faces. But Amru, how did you get to Eton? That's the bit I'm kind of fascinated by. I mean, how does a wee boy from an Iraqi family, where were you living?
I was living in Chiswick at the time.
And you were going to the local comprehensive in Chiswick?
It was like an international school.
Was there other people, did you know other people who went to Eton?
No. It was very bad academically as a school.
How did you find out about what did you have to do to get in?
Well, when I came to the UK and had already had OCD by this point, and you know, I talk about this in my book, but with Islam, you are taught to sort of visualize angels on your left and right shoulder, and bad deeds go on your left and good deeds go on your right, and you're supposed to continually sort of basically just count the whole time, and my left shoulder was sort of dwarfing my right sort of by age 7, and I was just constant, and actually chiropractors always say that my left side is harder to adjust, which I think
I was going to say you might have like a stoop because of that.
Yeah. And I also had I'm fine by the way, but I had, when I was at Cambridge, I had tumors on my left leg, which were benign, but my left side has suffered. I will say that.
Wow.
And so my thing when I came was just, it was, I think, definitely a manifestation of, I've got so many bad points, I need to now get good points wherever I could. And I translated that into just academics. I think a lot of queer people, and this has been written about by loads of queer people, you know, that sort of drive for perfection that a lot of gay people have, whether it's kind of aesthetic or in their career or whatever, because you feel obviously that you've got this failing. And for me, it was quite extreme because I was told, you know, you're going to go to hell or your parents are going to do this. So I just thought I'll just get 100% in everything. And so, you know, I was a straight A student. and had just Googled Eton when I was just fantasizing about it, and saw that they offered these things called sixth form scholarship. When I told my parents, they were actually quite in a kind of classic Iraqi way. It was a fun thing to boast about because they thought, you know, so, I mean, I think they were actually quite happy I was going as well, because I was becoming, I mean, home was just a nightmare for everyone.
And isn't there, right. isn't there a sort of an inbuilt kind of bullying and kind of, there's a thing, do they still have fags? It's a system where like a younger student has to be a sort of a slave for an older student. Does that still exist?
So that had gone by the time that I arrived, though it was there in a kind of structural sense, in the like fact that the first year boys, so, you know, the 13-year-olds who just arrived would have to, you know, deliver laundry to the older boys, deliver the laundry to the older boys. And I mean, Eton is all about hierarchies. I mean, you know, in your final year, you get given a different kind of waistcoat to differentiate you. If you're a house captain, you wear like a green one. If you're part of this kind of eliting sports club called POP, you get to wear any kind of waistcoat you want. If you're really clever, you get to have silver buttons. And it's meant to sort of, and also there were teachers who you handed in homework, obviously, like every week, and on the board, the order of the class would just, you would see it change sort of every week, like who was top of the class. And the year before I arrived, they used to read out the exam results from bottom order, from bottom. So they would go 200 in front of everyone, 264th in a year was blah, 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 blah. Well, I'm quite interested in terms of actually like engineering a Tory, or like engineering someone who would sort of, it ingrains in you from such a young age. I was only there 16 to 18, sorry. So, you know, I was able to sort of, I hope, not be fully kind of warped by it. But I do think it engineers a system that constantly makes you think of like, I need to be on top so someone can be at the bottom. And, you know, being left wing was so transgressive there. And, you know, and it is just like a hallway to power, really. I don't know what it's like now. I hear there's an LGBT society now.
There was nothing like that when you were there.
Oh, no, definitely not. Though I was always the leading lady in the school productions.
Oh, it's the main part. But I wanted to ask you about around that time, when did you start to differentiate between queerness and non-binariness, and how did you find the language for that? And, you know, did you even have it then? And
no, I mean, I definitely didn't have it then. I mean, I was, you know, 16. And I think at that point, I don't think I had even differentiated queerness from Britishness, really. you know,
I've been in some scrapes.
You know, but just, I just thought, you know, in that, it's only now that I'm understanding kind of colonialism and why the Middle East has gone the way that it has, that I'm understanding that the Middle East was actually once quite progressive when it came to sexuality. But, you know, from that very small kid's eye, all I saw was in the Middle East, I was told that, you know, I was told I would be shot. I mean, families would laugh about it, you know, oh yeah, shoot a gay person whenever you see them. And when you're told what hell is, you know, you're supposed to close your eyes and visualize it, and it's not a fun place, although not actually dissimilar to fire in Vauxhall. I just thought, yay, I'm in the UK where I've walked in Soho and seen gay people and they've not been shot. So the West, British, you know, I think I saw being gay as just like a renunciation of being Arab, which that's right. where I was. So I wasn't even dealing. I was obviously dealing with gender dysphoria in a massive way, but my way of dealing with it was to try and be one of the lads back then. And, you know, my God, like I even tried to play rugby, and the teacher, oh God. And also the teacher was such a twat, like he knew how I would be pulverized. And he made me hold the dump tackle so that everyone could practice tackling for an entire...
This is where you go, that? Reader, oh, I married terrible. Him.
That's terrible. Can you believe that?
Yes, that's awful.
Just like me. And also, I was so, so thin and scrawny, like in a worrying way. I was like, it was like I would have snapped. I did snap. Mm. I dislocated my shoulder, actually.
Oh, no. The concept of gender dysphoria is such a complex one, isn't it? Because it's very specific for individual people, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And like, because I didn't have the language when I was 14, let's say, but I had a lot of gender dysphoria because I didn't match up to what other people were like. And I went to a school a bit like you're describing, and everyone, it was just a weird atmosphere and all the rest of it. But I think that what, like, the journey I sort of went on in my head was like, oh, gender dysphoria, like hating the feeling like I don't match up to the gender that people say I am, feeling there's something wrong inside me, not really understanding it. But then kind of looping back on that and saying, actually, just because I don't match your shit idea of what it is to be, your narrow idea of what it is to be a man, that doesn't mean I'm not a man. Mm-hmm, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. then, but being non-binary is such a different thing, and something that people who listen to this show feel, who are non-binary, feel underrepresented. So, but what is the difference there for you, and how did you get there?
Yeah, that's really interesting question, and really, yeah, I think there are some kind of differences between men who don't conform to kind of social tropes of masculinity to people who it's not only sort of tropes of masculinity. That's never really, I think, where my dysphoria came out, never really came out in terms of, oh, I don't like, I'm not saying this is what yours was like at all, but I'm just trying to kind of verbalize it. You know, I'm not strong, or I'm not a fighter, or I'm not into any of these things that the boys are. For me personally, and it's different for every different non-binary person, it was like a really strong identification with like the feminine, but not just in terms of social tropes, but in terms of embodying it physically and dressing up in a way that was really rejecting masculinity on every level. So by what I was wearing and the makeup that I was putting on and the you know, just kind of language of my body and the way I wanted others to see me. So to me, it's never, my kind of dysphoria has never come out of a disidentification with what a man should be doing, because I don't think I've ever really bought into that ever. It was more like oddly how I related to my own body. And
so it's not a rejection of the masculine. It was an attraction to the feminine.
Yeah, and it was like a deep relationship with it. So much so that masculine signifiers in terms of pronouns, he, or made me feel really uncomfortable. But you know, I wasn't really aware that I could change my pronoun really till quite, you know, till like 5 years ago or so. So, and it was also definitely about actively trying to live in the in between and in another space. I don't think so. I've been, even if I'm like on a holiday with like 30 gay men, who are really feminine, and maybe some of them, you know, but if the most of them define as men,
quite the holiday,
men,
by the way.
I went on one. Yeah, yeah. Well, like Mykonos, where I just was, which was its own kind of hell. I'm not going to lie. But it's just like, oh, I don't feel in my body like I'm one of you. And it's not, and it's because it's like, I'm not identifying with manhood in any way. But for me, it came out of like a really deep attachment to femininity, which has a lot to do with my mother. And also, you know, this like kind of aching desire to constantly dress up and wear feminine stuff and be perceived as feminine. And, you know, I don't really know where that comes from and how I learned that, but that is, so that's where mine came out of.
And when did that, I mean, because I was thinking, like, that must be quite difficult to eat in when you've got to wear a, although in a way that sounds like, well, you're talking about the different waistcoats and that sounds like drag of a kind.
Yeah. I mean, I, for me, and this has always been the case since from a young age, was I was always quite a natural performer and I could always embody that space in performance. And at Eton, which is obviously all boys school, I was always just the natural person. I always just played the women and just felt so free in that way. And it was kind of weird. It was like, whenever I played women in the school productions and was good and was funny, you know, all the boys who had previously bullied me were laughing and loving it and having a really, really great time. And I think it's that thing of potentially of when you're trying to be masculine and failing, it's easier to for people to come after you. But when I was embodying the feminine, which was so much more natural to me, and doing it well, it's kind of quite hard to go after someone who's doing the thing that you think is a bit of a, you know, that's why drag is so wonderful, because it's, you can't make fun of a drag queen because they're doing it to themselves. They're not even making fun of themselves. They're going, yeah, and what? And it's amazing. And you know, and that's really why drag has been so wonderful for me, because all those things that I was taught were weaknesses suddenly are these things that are really galvanizing and take up so much space and are so much powerful that it would be weird if someone was like, you're in a dress, mate. You're like, well, yeah, and I look great. So what the fuck are you talking about? And so weirdly at school, the times when I got bullied the least was when I just fully was embodied in femininity. Where's the parameters with, yeah. And that was like, because everyone was like, oh, wow, well, that person clearly knows who they are. But when I was walking around going like, hey, lads and governors, like, check out my bitch here in this photo, people would be like, you're, you know.
But then you had a beautiful moment where you were doing one of your first drag shows, which was really putting yourself out there, right? Mm-hmm. And you were, but there was this beautiful moment that was sort of the intersection of your queerness and your dragness and being a Muslim all coming together with these women who were watching the show. Can you tell us about that? Hi everyone, isn't this the loveliest chat with Amru? So that's the end of part one. Don't forget to join us for part two, which is available now, so it'll be next on your feed. Go find it, click on it, and keep listening to our lovely chat with Amru.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Powered by Spirit Studios.